changes, but nothing in terms of the people that have been there for decades, and their family even for centuries. My family's been in Newark almost 100 years. I mean, so there's nothing been given to those folks. Job training, job development, infrastructure redevelopment, roads, bridges, highways, hospitals, schools, putting people to work, giving people jobs, giving people decent education. All of that is necessary in a democracy and to move America forward. I think America will never be what they purport it to be until they begin to invest in its urban centers. And in order for them to be able to do that, they have to get rid of the racism, which disallows them from investing in these cities the way they ought to. If we had that money, there would be a lot that we could do in terms of poverty in these communities, in terms of violence and gun violence, which is really bred by poverty and isolation and anger and, you know, post-traumatic stress. All of that stuff can be dealt with if we had that money.
Well, Ross Baracco, we want to thank you very much for being with us. The mayor of Newark, New Jersey, elected in May 2014, the city about to celebrate its 350th anniversary. That does it for our broadcast. If you'd like to get a copy of today's show, go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is hiring a director of development to lead our fundraising efforts. Find out more at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Nermeen Sheikh, Sam Alkoff, Robbie Caron, Steve Martinez. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8:01. Coming up next is more talk radio with Celeste Carey and Cecil Prescott. Today's guest is Richard Baxley, staff attorney at FlyersRights.org. We'll talk about their recent article, Airline Monopolies, Back to the Future.
KBOO Community Radio currently has a one-to-one match for all new and increasing members. A $100 new or increased donation will become $200 to support the important work of KBOO.
If you become a member at this time or increase your donation over last year, your donation will be matched one-to-one by a group of generous donors up to $10,000. Consider becoming a monthly sustaining member. This can be set up easily and securely online. Over 70% of KBOO's income is from you, our listeners, who take action to become KBOO members.
Go to kboo.fm/support to have your donation matched today, or mail your donation to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon 97214. Thank you for supporting KBOO.
This week on Religion for Life, we talk politics and religion with Joseph Baker.
Religion essentially became a political tool, something that politicians used in order to try to garner votes.
Joseph Baker is a sociologist at East Tennessee State University and author of American Secularism. Find weekly podcasts on kboo.fm/religionforlife.
That's the in the spot.
On November 28th, from 2 p.m. until 5 p.m., keep your head to the sky as Grassroot News continues our musical profiles, pointed directly at the elements. Oh my God, earth, wind, and fire. The fantasy, the true devotion, the serpentine fire, and what are the reasons? Earth, wind, and fire, on Saturday, November 28th, from 2 p.m. until 5 p.m. Join us as we deconstruct Earth, Wind, and Fire, their music, their message, and their love songs. Saturday, November 28th, from 2 p.m. until 5 p.m. on KBOO Portland.
Tune in this Thursday from 8 a.m. to noon for an Indigenous takeover on Thanksgiving Day. Listen to Native poetry, a discussion on Native urban life and wellness, and much, much more. Again, that's this Thursday, 8 a.m. to noon. on the 26th of November, Thanksgiving Day, here on KBOO Portland.
Good morning. Today is Monday, November 23rd, 2015, and you're listening to KBOO Community Radio, 90.7 in Portland, 91.9 in Hood River, 104.3 in Corvallis, and KBOO.FM via the World Wide Web. This is Cecil Prescott, and you are listening to More Talk Radio. Phone numbers for you to join us in a few minutes are 503-231-8187. But I invite you to pause and listen to our morning conversation. Many of us are preparing to make a pilgrimage somewhere, usually by an airplane, and hoping we will get there in time for the holiday. And I'm sure each one of us have some horrible stories. This morning, we'll be talking about the airlines and the role they play and what things we can do to challenge the monopolies and other issues surrounding those. We're speaking this morning about airline monopolies and other issues. Our guest will share some of his thoughts and wisdom about that. And so we invite you to join us as we speak with Richard Baxley, who is a staff attorney at FlyerRights.org. Good morning, Mr. Baxley.
Good morning, Cecil.
Perhaps we'll begin by just sharing a little bit information about your organization, its purpose and vision and mission.
Certainly. So Flyers Rights is a small nonprofit. We operate an office in Washington, D.C., and we mostly advocate for airline passenger rights, both at the Department of Transportation, the Federal Aviation Administration, and also with legislation on Capitol Hill. We were founded in 2006, and our founder, Kate Hanai, had a 9-hour tarmac delay in Austin, Texas, meaning the airplane had left the gate, and prior to taking off, it was stuck on the tarmac for 9 hours. So, you know, the bathrooms were overflowing, they had run out of food and water, et cetera, a kind of horrific incident happened to her, and she realized that she really had no redress against it. So she kind of left her job as a realtor and kind of went to D.C. and kind of wanted to make a difference and change something. And over the last, you know, 7+ years, we've grown to our organization now with 50,000+ members and supporters. And we've had a direct impact in getting new rules, the 3-hour tarmac rule through DOT, and also some regulation in the 2012 FAA Modernization Act. And we continue to, you know, work towards those goals today.
You mentioned your founder and her horror stories of remaining on the tarmac for many, many hours. And I was speaking with someone just before coming on the air who was preparing for his pilgrimage to from Portland to Pittsburgh. And you know, every time we go to the airport, we it seems as if we're never quite sure of what our experience would be like. I remember a time when flying was thought of as an exciting adventure. People got dressed up. They went to the airport, got on the airplane, maybe had a meal that was satisfactory and could be assured that they would be arriving at a reasonable time. That doesn't seem to be the experience of too many people these days. Could you possibly pinpoint a time when air travel began to change for most Americans?
Definitely. The biggest change definitely happened in 1978. Prior to 1978, the federal government controlled fully routes, service, pricing for all the airlines. And so they controlled how many flights there were from, city A to city B. They controlled what those flights would cost, et cetera. The airline industry was deregulated in 1978, and that allowed initially sort of a huge increase in competition. Now people were charging different, rates for the same service. People were charging different levels of service, et cetera. And so you actually saw ticket prices drop precipitously. But at the same time, you also saw service degrade a little bit in terms of how air travel was treated, in terms of what benefits and what food you were served, et cetera. And so I think initially it had a net positive impact. Rates did go down. It did get cheaper. But however, consolidation in the airline industry in the last 10, 15 years has kind of reversed that trend a little bit. So I think 78 is the big kind of delineation between what air travel was and what air travel is now.
And in a sense, since that deregulation, and there's been a consolidation of those airlines that control most of the market, I read recently in one of the articles from your organization that four giant air carriers control about 87% of the American market. That type of monopoly seemed to generate a horrible situation for many people. Tell us about the merging of these airlines together.
Certainly. So after deregulation in the 80s, we had a large increase in the number of market entrants, new airlines being formed, et cetera. And then the 90s kind of stayed level, and then the late 90s, 2000s started a downward trend. So in the last 15 years, we've gone from 10 significant airlines now down to four. So, you had Delta merged with Northwest, you had Continental merging with United, American Airlines has just finished completing their merger with U.S. Airways, Southwest bought AirTran, et cetera. So you went from, 8-10 major players, if you will, down to four, which, as you mentioned, control 80%+ of the domestic market. And this kind of consolidation has really, to a large degree, kind of pushed back to those gains we got from deregulation, because it's no longer a truly competitive industry where everyone, competes with each other, but instead you have four carriers who it's in their benefit to not compete because they're in an advantageous situation where they can prevent new market entrants from forming, but also benefit from the lack of government regulation.
How much of the decline in airlines may have been due to the 9/11 fiasco as far as the market was concerned? Did that have any effect on it?
Certainly, both after 9/11, there was a big decrease in the number of passengers, leading to severe losses in revenue for the airlines, which was then kind of a double whammy when you had the recession, five plus years later, it had the same kind of issue. And so that was kind of what led, that kind of sparked the latest, wave of mergers, is because the airline industry was so unhealthy for, almost a decade there. And as the other articles have mentioned, the airline industry has perennially been one of losing money, not making profits. And consolidation is kind of their response to that. However, it's gotten to the point where, you've gone from, 10 carriers to four, that it's no longer just helping them avoid losing money, but instead they've had record profits both in 2014 and now 2015.
And is that due to just price increases? Because a little while ago, we were hearing about the impact of the price of oil and therefore gasoline on both travel and shipping.
Certainly. In the last year plus, the price of jet fuel has come down, I think, 40%, nearly cut in half. However, you have not really seen that passed along to consumers. Airfares in the last year, I believe, are down like 1-2%, and over the last decade, they were actually up about 5% after looking at inflation. I think the biggest issue that if it was a more competitive industry, the different airlines would be forced to lower their fares to compete with one another. But given consolidation, they can just turn those lower costs into profits.
You're listening to KBOO. This is More Talk Radio with myself, Cecil Prescott, and Celeste Carey. We're speaking this morning with Richard Baxley of FlyersRights.org. If you have a question or comment about the airlines, give us a call at 503-231-8187.
One of the questions that I saw in terms of both articles and doing a little online research is the question of competition versus consolidation. Which one is worse? Now, I would imagine because we're not having competition, we would think that having competition would be an advantage. But what would spark that kind of title for an article that you, you've mentioned that with the increase of consolidation, I figure besides price gouging, there must have been some other horrible thing that has befallen us travelers.
I think aside from just price gouging in general, it's the way it's being done. For example, airline fares themselves, while they have gone up, have not gone up that much. What airlines are turning to is ancillary fees, so bag fees, change fees, et cetera.
And breathing fees.
Yeah, exactly. So everything, there's a fee now for everything. And so whether your base fare for a flight might be $200, you might end up spending $150 in fees on top of that. And that's not really included for most of these metrics. For example, the excise tax that applies to airline fares the government collects doesn't apply to fees. And so a lot of things like that that make it advantageous for airlines to go with a higher fee structure, but keeping the base fare similar to what it had been. And consolidation allows them to do that because with only four major carriers, the big three, Delta, United, and American, you often see these kind of parallel increases. Both they change like a change fee to $200 for United, American, and Delta quickly follow. And so you see they have the ability to just kind of those parallel increases track what the others are doing. And as long as they have those similar fee structures, consumers are really left with no choice.
Speaking about consumers, one of the things that your organization backed was a Department of Transportation regulation that would at least require us to be able to find out what are we paying for in
right.
terms of the full ticket price. What is the status of that?
Well, right now, the previous bill that addressed these kind of issues was the 2012 FAA Modernization and Reform Act. That reauthorization happens every 2 or 3 years, hopefully, but oftentimes it's pushed back. The next wave of that would be in March, is the upcoming deadline. And so any sort of legislation on the Hill in the Congress or Senate going through would likely get folded into that in a couple more months. Now, at the same time, the two biggest regulators in the government for the aviation industry, the Federal Aviation Administration, and then the Department of Transportation. The FAA handles safety and, you know, the actual planes themselves, and then DOT has an Office of Aviation Consumer Protection that looks at the actual kind of protections for consumers, both in terms of, you know, false advertising or regulating fees, et cetera. And that department has done a lot of good in terms of disclosures, making sure that airlines disclose what fees are what, those kind of removing those kind of unfair and deceptive practices. They have not taken much steps, and a lot of times they're kind of unable to take steps to actually regulate the fees themselves or those kind of more involved practices with how the routes or pricing works.
And why are they unable or unwilling? Is it lobbying that's keeping us from having more equitable pricing?
That's certainly part of it. The airlines together spend a lot of money on Capitol Hill, both themselves and through Airlines for America, their trade group. So they definitely have a very strong presence. For example, Chairman Schuster, who's in the House, and as the chairman of the Direct House Committee Regulating Airlines, is currently dating one of the chief lobbyists for Airlines for America.
Isn't that called collusion?
His chief of staff used to work there. And so there's definitely a lot of tie-in between the industry and those that regulate it, you know. So that's definitely a big issue. Another issue is the fact that, for example, the DOT has their power is limited because when the airlines were deregulating, deregulated in 1978, the act that did that had a preemption, for example, of certain state and local laws. Like the main state attorney general can't regulate the airlines, leaving DOT as the sole regulator. However, their ability to regulate things like route service pricing and stuff, they don't have the statutory authority to do a lot of that. So they're kind of limited in what they're actually able to regulate because Congress never gave them that authority.
And it sounds like maybe Congress isn't interested in giving them the authority.
I think so.
Oh.
We're speaking this morning with Richard Baxley of FlyersRight.org about airlines. Numbers are 503-231-8187. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I just want to say right off that I'm glad my long distance and regular flying days are over from recent experience. I'd like to ask your guest, I read in a good source, reader supported news recently, that American airlines, I don't mean just the one airline, but U.S. airlines in general, are farming out their maintenance to other countries now, and even to China and a lot of Central American countries, where the regulations are much less stringent. God knows how you get a crippled airliner over to China, but I'd like to hear if you have any comments on that. And you know, that to me is kind of dangerous procedure. So I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thank you for your call.
I think I don't have looked into that directly, and Flyers Rights, typically we've kind of gone on the kind of consumer protection route for what we've been involved with, and less on the kind of the FAA side about maintenance or the actual, you know, aircraft themselves. I do know that most of the main maintenance is done in America, but I do believe the aircraft, yes, are serviced abroad, but I honestly can't speak to what extent that is.
So let's think about the consumer who is either considering buying a ticket or has already bought a ticket for the holidays. What type of consumer's protections are there in terms of, one, making sure you get a ticket that's reasonably priced, and what should we be aware of when we purchase tickets?
I think the biggest one, as I mentioned earlier, with the fee structure being so complex now, is be very cognizant of what type of fare you're buying, and also be cognizant of what different airline fees and rules apply to that. For example, some of the discount carriers like Spirit now charge for carry-ons, and if you prepay it, it's a small charge. If you show up to the airport and you're unaware of that, it's a significant charge you could pay.
It could be as much as $100 and more.
Exactly. And so I think the biggest thing to consumers, you have to read all the fine print. You have to be very careful at examining, because airfare used to be you bought a fare that came with certain expectations. You had a free checked bag. You could bring a carry-on. You got a meal, et cetera. Airfare nowadays has really been divorced from any kind of meaning. So the fare is just the base fare you pay. But when you think of that as a consumer, it doesn't really get you what you think anymore. You know, you might have to pay for a checked bag. You might have to pay for a carry-on. You might have to pay for a bottle of water on board, et cetera. So to be very aware of what you're actually purchasing when you purchase it.
I've also noticed that sometimes you get caught in the catch-22, and you mentioned baggage fees. If you decide, well, I'll carry it on, because most of them have had check fees, then they'll charge you for carry on. And if you decide, okay, I'll check one, and then I'll just carry on the one with my personal items, well, you get charged for that one too. So it's a matter of reading what the fine print says. Now, one of the things I'm kind of amazed and amused at, and I don't know if you can speak to this at all, but it's the wars over seat reclining or not, and the fact that the airlines are giving you such a small amount of space that it has turned into a turf war almost to just sit down in your seat.
Certainly. I know 10, 20 plus years ago, the average seat pitch, which is the space between the back of your seat and the front, or the back of the seat in front of you, and where your back sits in your seat. That space used to be about 35 inches on average for the industry. Now it's down to about 31. So you've seen a loss of 4 inches. Some discount carriers, like Spirit, for example, actually have 28 inches of seat space, so 7 inches less than what it used to be.
Or it doesn't decline, recline.
Correct. I've had Spirit seats also that does just not have reclining recline. Seats.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so there's definitely been a loss of space. I think the average width of a seat has gone from like 18, 19 inches now down to about 17 as well. So you're about an inch or two narrower on the sides, and you also have lost between, you know, 5-plus inches of seat pitch. So you have way less leg room as well. And that has caused a whole host of issues. I know one man invented a device called the Knee Defender, which locks into the seat in front of you, preventing it from reclining.
Mm-hmm.
That way, he invented it to save his knees. He's a taller guy. But that leads to someone in front of you wants to recline. You have that device, they can't. And then there's incidents like that where people passengers end up arguing, and it's actually come to blows at times. So flight attendants have definitely reported there's been much more angry interaction between passengers because they do have less space, and as a result, they tend to fight with each other more.
Ouch.
So that's one of the problems, that, as you mentioned, in terms of struggling for space. I've heard recently in terms of passengers being kicked off of flights for all sorts of reasons. What are our rights in terms of when we get on the airline and sit down? And why it seems to be people, when they're confronted with being asked to leave the plane, is that a trend, or is it just my perception?
I think it seems to be a little bit of a trend, both in terms of passengers having less space and generally a more aggravating experience leading to more issues, but also with terrorist fears leading to more people being asked to leave planes. For example, a recent flight, I believe out of Baltimore, a woman went to use the restroom with her young child when the plane was taxiing, which you're not allowed to get up at the time. And so passengers reported suspicious behavior, and the pilot, you know, turned the plane back to the gate, and she was removed from the plane for doing that. And so passengers really, whether their activities are innocent or not, have very little leeway with what they're allowed to get away with on the plane. The pilot has a lot of authority on whether to land the plane as an emergency landing, to take it back to the gate, etc. So unfortunately, when a flight attendant tells you to do something, even if it's something minor or if you disagree with it, you really have no ability to really push back on that, lest, you know, the pilot decides that, no, you do need to be removed. So I think the biggest thing for passengers is just to realize that while you're on the flight, following the directives of the flight crew and the pilot are what you need to do.
We're speaking this morning with Richard Baxley of FlightIsRight.org about airlines and what it's like to fly these days. If you have a question or comment, perhaps you have a beautiful story of your recent air flight, or you had a problem, give us a call and share those. 503-231-8187.
One of the other things that you find is that depending upon where you're flying from, whether it be regional or in terms of country, you don't necessarily pay the same price for a ticket. Can you give us a little insight on that? I've noticed that if I do it from one zip code, sometimes the price has changed, or if I'm using a different IP address, whether it's like using my phone for and my data plan, which may not reflect an IP or region, or if I'm, say, traveling out of California, I've noticed sometimes the prices change according to your address or the country you're in.
Very much so. Airline pricing models are incredibly complex, so much so that I don't fully understand how they work. But they've had a lot of time, effort, and money put into them to get the optimal mix for the airlines in terms of how full the flights are, how much people are paying, et cetera. And so you're right, that varies a lot by what time you purchase the ticket. Price can change minute to minute. It can also change on your location or what currency you're paying in. So if you go through the Denmark website of a flight you're trying to fly to Denmark versus buying through the U.S. website of that airline, that can have a different price. If you're paying in, you know, kroner or U.S. dollars or euros or whatever, that can have a difference on what price you're getting, different than the actual the exchange rate would be. And so that's one thing that has been looked at, that consumers, if you change your IP address, you actually can get a different price. And I've known, there's an article recently in the Washington Post about this, talking about the ethics of that as a consumer. If you're kind of trying to get around what the airline's doing by changing your IP address or going through a different website than the airline's, you know, U.S. website, and the impact on that. And so I think it's kind of a gray area, both in terms of what the airlines are doing and what passengers are kind of ethically able to do to get around that, if you will.
Well, given the fact that they're gaming us, I would think it would kind of even out. We have less advantages on our side.
I definitely tend to agree. The Washington Post article kind of cited people from different experts, either professors in ethics or et cetera, talking about it. And I definitely tend to agree with you that given how complex this scheme is and how airlines are kind of gaming it to get the most money out of us, I think it's only fair that as long as what we're doing is legal to find ways to minimize our airfare.
In terms of the work you do, you know, it seems as if there's so many issues. And just from the conversation just now, I'm wondering if your organization ever gets any tips or insights from airline insiders, employees, in terms of what's really happening.
I personally have not been involved with that. I know the president of the organization, Paul Hudson, and our founder, Kate Hannay, are both been doing this for, you know, years now. Especially Mr. Hudson has been doing this for decades. And they both have had a lot of contact with flight attendants, with pilots, with people within the airlines and management. And they've definitely had a good look at the inside of what life is really like or what's really happening. I've only been with Flyers Rights about a year myself as an attorney, and so I haven't personally dealt with that, but I do know it's a good source of information that we take in.
Mm-hmm. And what about, what is the role, speaking of airlines fees and consolidation and all of that, what is the role of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau? You know, all that brouhaha that when it was finally established. Is there a role there for that? That
unfortunately, there doesn't really seem to be. As I said, with the 78 deregulation, it really left DOT as the kind of sole regulator for in this area. And so in another industry, you might have the Federal Trade Commission, you might have the CFPB, as you mentioned, helping consumers. In the airline industry itself, you're really left with DOT's Aviation Consumer Group. And so that's really the only regulator and the only place consumers can really turn, unfortunately. And so I think the airline industry being kind of specially exempted that way is a negative thing and something that we at Flyers Rights are trying to fix.
What is the word, Celeste, or maybe you, for the opposite of mergers? So is that a possibility for that to happen in terms of
the businesses separating or spinning off or splitting?
Would that help things if there were more airlines?
More competition.
I definitely think so. While we've had some issues with some of the discount carriers like Spirit or Frontier, et cetera, and some of their practices in terms of fee disclosure or what they're, you know, doing to seat sizes, at the same time, we definitely like the fact that there's now new entrants that give consumers the ability to choose other flights. All too often at certain airports, for example, I know like United at Newark or Delta and Atlanta, et cetera, certain cities are just so dominated by one airline. Consumers really have no choices on a lot of routes. And so anytime we can see new entrants into the market gaining share, or if we could see a major airline split up, I think that would be net a very good thing for consumers to introduce more competition, give them more choice, et cetera. However, I think it's very unrealistic to expect one of the major airlines to break apart, at least in the near future. The trend has definitely been towards consolidation, not the other way.
And it seems whenever there's consolidations, or, you know, in recent years when we heard yet another merger, it seems to get the okay with not much resistance from the feds. Why is that? Oh, I think I know why.
That's pretty true. Yeah. With American and U.S. Airways being the most recent large merger, DOJ initially opposed it, and after about a year of opposition, you know, eventually folded and it came to a settlement agreement. And that agreement had certain issues. For example, U.S. Airways and American at that point in control upwards of, I think, 90% of the slots at Reagan National Airport in D.C. And so part of the settlement agreement is they had to sell some of those slots and divest. And there's other agreements, I think, at Philadelphia and some other airports, too. And so the settlement agreement was better than nothing. However, the opposition from the Department of Justice really did, as you said, fold and just kind of let it happen. And so at this point, with four major airlines controlling 80% of the market, I imagine that another merger of one of those four to each other going forward would be fought, I hope. But it definitely has appeared that the antitrust authorities have, you know, as you alluded to, just the strength and money and the lobbying for the airlines has really prevented them from effectively opposing these mergers.
Well, see, and that's something that kind of bothers me, because given the fact that we've had some challenges on airlines, some of them mechanical, some of them in terms of their processes, you would think that consumer protection might have arisen regardless of the amount of money that they have to lobby. Now, I had a trip, I want to say it might have been about 5 years ago, maybe less, where I was traveling, and I was coming back from Boston, Massachusetts, and flying the northernmost route. I think we were coming over Montana when one of the engines died in the plane, and we had to land in Helena, and not only was it frightfully cold, but the thing that was most interesting was the jet we were flying in was way too big to land at Helena. So they had all manner of flashing lights out there waiting for us with big foam pumps and everything. Now, I'm thinking, they were nice. They gave us pizza. We stayed at the airport for a good 8 to 10 hours, you know, while they fixed the plane. But I'm thinking, had anybody had any health challenges or any significant business to attend, it would have all been lost. Now, are there no consumer protections for that type of situation, or do they just merely say, well, look, that's an act of God. How are we to know an engine's going to crap out?
That's that's actually a very big issue, is the fact there are no federal rules or regulations about what airlines have to provide to you if you are delayed, whether it's some sort of act of God, like a snowstorm, whether it's a mechanical failure of the aircraft, or even if it's just scheduling conflicts or delays the airline's experiencing. And their contracts of carriage that you have to, you know, de facto sign when you buy your ticket, the airlines lay out what they will or won't provide, but there's no actual federal requirement. There's no baseline, so they can provide you with nothing if they want to. Mm-hmm. And so that's, I think, a significant issue, that either through a DOT rulemaking or through legislation to get some sort of baseline, that they have to put you up in a hotel or they have to give you at least, you know, so many meals, et cetera. But unfortunately, as it currently stands, there is no regulation on that.
You're listening to More Talk Radio on KBOO. Our numbers here are 503-231-8187. And we'll go to James. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. So a question for the guest. So I heard you mentioning earlier that the airline prices can change based on IP addresses. There's a lot of factors. Have you noticed that there's maybe maybe it's a ridiculous question, but have you ever seen a significant price difference between difference between maybe white flyers and flyers who are persons of color? If you could change the price based on IP address, I mean, you would certainly think that maybe if you were ordering, you know, you were purchasing from an area where they knew it was more like they want to consider it low rent, or use that sort of language, that they would kind of up the ante on the price.
That's one thing we have not seen. It seems to be based more upon country of origin. For example, if you're buying a ticket in Santiago, Chile versus Germany versus the United States, there might be a significant difference in price. But in terms of a different IP address in the U.S. based upon, you know, sort of racial or economic factor, that might exist, but it is not something we have seen any evidence of.
Well, just thought I'd ask. It seems like maybe something that might have come up. I've heard some stories from different flyers where they, you know, maybe it's demographic, but, you know, being jerked around about where their seating is. I read a story about a Native American guy who was, they actually almost barred him from the plane because he was slated to sit next to a couple of older white folks, and they were not comfortable with his size or his way of dressing. And so they almost had him kicked off the plane because the folks were not happy that he was sitting next to them. So I don't know.
There have been issues like that. I know, for example, between flights between Israel and the U.S., there's been issues where Orthodox Jewish men have refused to sit next to women, and the airline has at various times either kicked people off the plane or they have had flights delayed, et cetera. So those issues with some passengers being uncomfortable with other passengers and either complaining themselves or the airline doing something, that does come into play when it comes to seating.
Okay. Thank you, James.
Thank you.
Most of our conversation has been talking about domestic flights. Does your organization work around issues about international flights as well?
We do. Domestic is obviously, you know, first in our mind, and that's kind of how we got started. But even, for example, with our founding issue, the kind of tarmac delays, they got through a three-hour rule, so if you're delayed over 3 hours on the tarmac on a domestic flight, you know, the airlines face fines and you have to be taken back to the gate. And that rule is also implemented for international flights, but there's a four-hour window for that, so that applies to both. Going forward, we definitely do look at international issues. We have a change fee petition pending before the Department of Transportation right now. What that is a rulemaking petition we filed that the department has to respond to, asking them to initiate a rulemaking using their authority over international fees and international pricing, which they still retain. They don't have it over domestic, but they do have it over international flights, to cap those kind of ancillary fees, specifically change fees, because domestic change fees hover around about $100, maybe $200 for a flight. Internationally, they can be as high as $750, $800. And so that's one thing we're definitely asking them to take a look at and fix.
So how can the average traveler make a difference? How do they get involved with your organization or any other organization to make a difference in the rules of the game?
I think the biggest thing they can do is, if you have a bad experience, make sure you talk about it and complain about it. The Department of Transportation logs all these flight complaints. If you go to transportation.gov/airconsumer, they have a form there. You can, you know, file a complaint with DOT. All those complaints are logged and addressed, and they will either, you know, point you to the person at the airport that can help, at either the airport or the airline that can address your issue. They will take a look at it themselves and try to address it. Or they will tell you that, you know, you have this complaint, but nothing is possible. But at least it allows them to log those as statistics. You may or may not get helped, but at least kind of shows that, hey, these incidents are happening and that they have this database of, you know, where they need to focus on. So that's definitely a good one to do. Another thing is just to make sure you contact your House reps and your senators, because they do listen to constituent concerns. And if they're getting hundreds and thousands of calls from their constituents, it'll lead them to actually hopefully take a stronger look at this kind of thing, both in a standalone bill maybe they would get behind, or at least supporting these kind of reforms in the next FAA reauthorization.
How likely is that to happen, given the fact that the lobbyists are pretty strong? Is that our only option to kind of push toward change?
Yeah, it's the kind of thing, unfortunately, a lot of this change is very gradual and it happens with time. And so people need to make a concerted effort. And so when there's specific incidences, for example, there's a large ice storm that causes a bunch of people to be stranded on a tarmac or for significant delays, those kind of events do lead to a lot of public anger and a kind of cry for change, but it peters out within a couple weeks. And so unfortunately, there has not been really the kind of sustained voice being raised of the consumer saying, no, we want this to be changed, and regardless of how much money is being spent by the airlines or how much lobbying influence they have, that no, that is something we want. And so it kind of takes that sustained engagement from the public, which mm-hmm. is hard to do, unfortunately, and it certainly isn't easy. Getting anything passed on Capitol Hill is incredibly difficult, and getting a large agency like DOT to, you know, introduce new regulations, also incredibly difficult. But it does happen. We have had wins in the past, like with truth in scheduling, with the three-hour rule for tarmac delays, et cetera. It can happen, so we just got to keep pushing.
And speaking in terms of Congress, are there, I don't know whether or not your organization rate congressional representatives, but are there, do you have any strong advocates for you in this Senate or the House?
Yeah, I've had some. I know in 2012, in the last big legislative push we got through, the original bill was Senator Snow from Maine, who's no longer there, and Senator Boxer from California were the two big proponents. We've also had a lot of help from Senator Blumenthal in Connecticut, Gillibrand, et cetera, in the House. We've actually talking to three different congressmen right now, working with their offices to draft legislation. I can't publicly talk about that right now. Sure. It's still kind of on the drafting stage, but I think we should see at least from two, if not all three of those, a bill in the coming months, hopefully, to help address some of these issues. So there is some engagement with us, our organization, and with public from, you know, the House and the Senate. But in general, it's definitely the minority of members who are actively working with us.
And in terms of your organization in and of itself, you gave us a brief summary of its history. Are there any particular projects or issues that you are working on or will be working on that you might want the public to be aware of?
Certainly. As I mentioned earlier, that change fee petition we have before the DOT right now, we submitted it back in February. The docket is already closed on that. You can no longer submit comments, but hopefully we'll get a response from them in the coming months. We also have a rulemaking petition we submitted in August that's before the Federal Aviation Administration, and that docket is still live, and the public can comment on that. And when making their decision whether or not to regulate, the FAA will look at those comments. And so if anyone wants to, the docket number is FAA-2015-4011-0001. And if you search for that docket number, you'll find it on their website, regulations.gov. And the public is allowed to comment on those petitions. You can download the petition itself, read what we're asking for, and submit your comments telling the FAA that, hey, we want you to support this.
Now, are these dockets also available, this information available at your website?
Yes. If you go to flyersrights.org, you can see our active petitions.
Okay. Finally, I'm sure there's been not a few people that are wondering, with the change in the seating area for each person to sit down, that there must be somebody within the health field that has a comment. Have you considered approaching this from a health perspective? Because sitting in cramped spaces and some of the most awkward shapes for tall people, I can imagine would be a cause for a vascular embolism.
Yeah.
How do the airlines account for that?
Well, in our petition on the seat space, we kind of hack it from three angles: the health, safety, and comfort. For the health, you raise a great point with deep vein thrombosis and people developing clots in their legs, then, you know, travel the rest of their body, and they can have incredibly serious health complications, if not death. And their studies definitely link the kind of sitting immobilized for long periods of time is definitely a contributory factor for developing those clots and developing those conditions. However, the science is not settle that for people that do not have risk factors, so if you're not someone at risk for those conditions, whether or not sitting on a typical airline flight, at least domestically, will really increase your risk that significantly. The biggest impacts are for those long flights, especially international, and also for people that come into the flight with those risk factors already present. In that case, they can actually have very serious health concerns. And the fact that you've seen seat pitch go from 35 inches down to now as low as 28, that you've lost an inch on the width of your seat, or 2 inches in some cases, does present the fact that you're now kind of wedged in those seats. You can't stretch your legs. It's hard to get up and out. And most people recommend that, health experts, that if you walk up and down the aisle, if you stand up, if you can flex your muscles, change your position of your legs, are all things that are proven to be beneficial to to keep you from developing these health conditions. And the fact that now seats are so small and cramped, I think, is definitely a very legitimate concern and something we address in our petition. Another one being safety, the fact that, for example, when they test evacuate planes, the current, the FAA testing only goes down to 31 inches of seat pitch, even though some planes are flying as low as 28 inches. So while it's only 3 inches, that does make a difference and impacts the ability of passengers to get out of their seats and into the aisle and then off the plane. So we also advocate that when the FAA test planes down to that 28-inch seat pitch to make sure that we're not hampering people's ability to get off the plane by making the seats ever smaller.
Well, that's kind of a cheat if they're not testing the average size of a plane.
Definitely.
We were speaking this morning about airlines and regulations. Our guest this morning is Richard Baxley, staff attorney at Flyers Rights. Our number is here, 503-231-8187. And good morning, Reggae Bob.
Good morning, Celeste and my man Celeste, and good to have you guest on board today. My question is, first I heard on another report that pets are going to be not allowed unless they're service animals on some flights with the Delta Airlines next year. And also, I'm in the middle of a dilemma right now with baggage. Baggage was lost in Dallas, Texas. And they've actually located it, but then they check back again, and they can't find it. And we have to, the consumer, we have to make a list of all the items inside, the emails, the phone calls, and they never get back to me. I have to do all the work. What's the deal with baggage and regulations?
Well, unfortunately, when it comes to the baggage issue, airlines are actually exempt from most of the kind of common law regulation. You know, the Uniform Abandoned Property Law applies to just about every other industry or anyone else who would have your property. Airlines are exempted from that. They're only required to hold lost bags for up to 90 days, and after that, they sell them wholesale, and they actually all end up at a storefront in rural Alabama, where they are then resold to the public, and they sell millions of, you know, lost articles there every year.
And so they make a profit.
Yes, very much.
And we don't.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow.
Alabama?
And so that's the way it currently works. And then you can file, you know, your claims with the airlines, and they, you know, have to respond to those claims, but the majority of them get denied. And so the airline, you know, requires proof of what you had in your bag, and they go back and forth with you, and they make the process incredibly difficult.
Okay, then now back to the Alabama thing again. Where it's resold. Can you say that again, please? The reselling.
So when luggage is lost and the airline is unable to locate the owner, so like, you know, the tag's ripped off and they don't look inside to identify the person, so it's just sitting there, and within 90 days, if it's not claimed by someone or if the airline can't locate the owner, it will actually be auctioned off and they sell it. And almost all the baggage in, you know, the U.S. that's lost that way and not claimed will then end up at a single store in Alabama where they then resell it to the public. And at that point, that store has an exclusive contract with all the major airlines, and so that's where almost all the lost baggage ends up that no one claims.
I want to find that store.
Yes.
That's my project. Thank you, sir. Thanks for the answer.
The second question he had was in terms of pets flying on the airlines.
Mm-hmm.
Were there any change in regulations around pets or on flying on airlines or service animals? Are you aware of?
I haven't looked into that specifically. I do know there has been some pushback from the airlines because some travelers misrepresent their pets as service animals trying to get
yes.
them on in the cabin themselves. So I think that's an issue
yes.
that people want to address.
I've experienced that, yes.
Mm-hmm. So at the same time, I think that's also led to somewhat of a backlash against service animals, unfortunately.
Unfortunately,
because people
yes.
doubt the legitimacy of a pet being a service animal or not. So I think that's where a lot of the current kind of issue there has come from.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of preparations, again, you shared some earlier in our conversation, but for those who are joining us late in the conversation, what are some some hints or some things people should do and first purchasing tickets, what things they should look out for, and then if they have problems, either purchasing or we'll deal with that first. What things people should do in terms of purchasing tickets?
Well, just realize that when you make the purchase, one benefit you have is through a DOT regulation is you have 24 hours to cancel that ticket with no penalty. So if you do purchase the ticket and you realize you spelled your name wrong on it or you find a better deal somewhere else, if it's within 24 hours of purchasing it, you can actually cancel that without penalty, and that's for every airline because it's a regulation, and then, you know, repurchase the ticket somewhere else. So that's one benefit. So if you have buyer's remorse or you find a better deal in 24 hours, you can do that. At that point, though, after 24 hours, you're now locked in. And that means you're subject to whatever change or cancellation fees the airline might have. So even if it's a family emergency or some other issue, you're really on the hook with the airlines. They might want to, you can work with them. You can certainly call them, contact them, and maybe they'll waive it. But oftentimes they don't. So unfortunately, even if you're canceling a year out, you still have to pay these change or cancellation fees. So just be aware of what those fees are and make sure that you're very certain to the best of your ability that you'll be flying with that ticket, because if you can't, oftentimes you lose it.
Wow. And then if I purchase a ticket, and most people purchase online now, so is there a difference between, I'm not even aware of in terms of individual flights, is it better to try to purchase yourself, or are there still a role for travel travel agents to help you? Do you have an opinion on that? Whether
for the average consumer purchasing a ticket for their personal use or for them and their family, I think just purchasing it themselves using the airline's website, using a third party like a Expedia or Orbitz or whatever, I think is certainly fine. Okay. I think travel agents still play an important role for many people in terms of maybe businesses using those or someone using it for more complex travel arrangement. But for a typical junior just flying from city A to city B, I think at this point most consumers are best served just doing it themselves, but just paying very careful attention to the fine print and to what that ticket actually is or isn't, and obviously what fees and everything else that might apply.
Okay, great. And let's go to our final caller. John, good morning.
Good morning. My question is, and thank you for the show, great job, is maybe I missed it, apologize if I did, is there a charge for obesity for people? Hey, we know we got an obesity and I was curious if any extra charge for obesity by the pound or whatever.
Okay, thank you, John.
Thank you.
There's no charge for the, to my knowledge, per the extra weight per pound or anything. I do believe airlines have different policies on this. Some might make you buy a ticket in first class or business class or something where you have a larger seat. Some might make you buy two seats. Some might have some other accommodation they reach. However, I don't believe there's any sort of, you know, poundage surcharge or anything not currently in effect. And so I think at that point you have to look at each individual airline and what their policies are for someone flying with an obesity issue. And I think that really depends on the significance of how large they are, because airplane seats, like I said, they've gotten smaller and smaller, while at the same time the average American's gotten heavier and heavier. And so that is a kind of big issue of contention there.
We've been speaking this morning with Richard Baxley, staff attorney at Flyers Rights, and thank you for joining us, Mr. Baxley. Could you give our listeners where people should go to find out more about your organization?
Yes, our website is our name, so just flyersrights.org, no space, and you can go there, and it has contact info for our current petitions before the government. For just public opinion and petitions we have, you can see what we've filed. Has contact information, et cetera. We have a office in D.C. we keep staffed. Then we also employ volunteers across the country who help us out. Another good website for just the average consumer, apart from ours still has information about, if you have an issue in the airline or if you have your flight gets canceled, et cetera, you can come to our website and find out what your rights really are. You can also call our hotline, which is 1-877-FLYERS-6, and we keep that. It's not staffed constantly, but if you even just leave a message, someone will get back to you within a matter of hours, and we can hopefully resolve some of your issues.
Well, thank you so much. I hope you have a good holiday and fly, have good flights.
Thank you very much. I'll be flying to Chicago on Thursday, so hopefully it all goes well.
Okay, great so much. Thank you so much. This has been More Talk Radio here on your community radio station, KBOO. For Celeste Carey, this is Cecil Prescott. We wish you a good day, and we will see you at another time, or speak with you at another time.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Raw Deal, a talk by author Stephen Hill on Tuesday, December 8th at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. Raw Deal challenges conventional thinking about the sharing economy by showing why it's the latest economic fraud. Again, that's Raw Deal, a talk by author Stephen Hill on Tuesday, December 8th at the First Unitarian Church, 1211 Southwest Main in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
I'm David Barsamyan, host of Alternative Radio, heard every Tuesday morning at 9 on KBOO. KBOO currently has a one-to-one match for all new and increasing members. If you become a member at this time or increase your donation over last year, your donation will be matched dollar for dollar up to $10,000 by a group of generous donors and foundations. Consider becoming a monthly sustaining member. This can be set up easily and securely online. Go to kboo.fm/support to get your donation matched today.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. Find some mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down, and I wish I was a mole in the ground.